and Alex looking like, "What are you doing?" And that was it. The Yankees advanced to a Subway Series against the Mets, though by evidence of the advance billing, the World Series itself seemed relegated to only a backdrop to the hyper-publicized personal war between Roger Clemens and Mike Piazza. Clemens had started against the Mets that year on July 8th at Yankee Stadium. Piazza had worn out Clemens in his career. In 12 at-bats, Piazza had raked Clemens for 7 hits, including 3 home runs and 9 runs batted in. McNamee, Clemens' since-estranged trainer, who used to help Clemens warm up in the bullpen before games, said he told Clemens just before the game, "Listen, you've got to cut that shit out. I mean, the guy, you've got to end that shit." McNamee said Clemens responded, "Don't worry." Piazza was the leadoff batter of the second inning of a scoreless game. Clemens obtained a called strike on the first pitch. His next pitch, a fastball, sailed toward Piazza's head. Piazza threw his hand up and ducked his head slightly at the last moment, but the baseball drilled him right on the front of his helmet. Piazza immediately fell limp to the ground in the manner of someone who had been shot. The Mets believed Clemens had thrown at Piazza intentionally. Piazza had to be removed from the game. While Piazza was being examined in the Mets clubhouse, Clemens called there to talk to him to see how he was feeling. There was some confusion about what happened next. Whether Piazza wasn't able to take the call at that moment, or whether he flat-out refused to take the call. All Clemens knew was that his attempt to talk to Piazza was rebuffed. "The worst I've seen him upset was when he hit Piazza," McNamee said. "He said, 'Mac, he won't pick up the phone. What should I do?' I said, 'Fuck him.' He goes, 'No, man, he won't pick up the phone. I've got to do something.' I said, 'Listen, I know Franco. You want me to go? I'll go get Franco.'" Mets reliever John Franco and McNamee both had attended St. John's. "So I went over to the clubhouse and I grabbed Franco," McNamee said. "I'm talking to John right outside the clubhouse and I'm going, 'Yeah, John, Roger just feels bad. He's in the locker room and he wants to speak with Mike.' And he goes, 'He's in there. He's a pussy. Fuck him. He's in the trainer's room.' And I went back and I told Roger that. And that's when Roger went on the offensive saying, 'Who gets hit and has a press conference?'" Said Torrey, "Piazza wouldn't take the call in the clubhouse, but that's understandable. I mean, we all thought Roger was that same person when he pitched against us and didn't know him. I mean, I hated him as an opponent for the shit that he did. I remember it was right before the All-Star break, and the All-Star game was in Atlanta and Bob Gibson was there. He told me, 'The guy never moved. He just sort of stayed there.' I said, 'Yeah, because the last thing he thought was that he was going to get hit in the head. Just wait till I step in, dig in, and throw the ball over here where I like it so I can knock the shit out of it.' Roger didn't throw at him. I mean, I'm not saying that he didn't try to push him back off the plate. I'm not saying he didn't do that. But he certainly didn't have any intention of hitting him." It was made for tabloid stuff. It was a bitter feud between two superstar players, Yankees versus Mets, New York versus New York. Clemens, finally earning his keep with the Yankees after a transitional year in 1999, played the role of the bad guy. The whole Piazza thing in 2000 kind of dominated that year for him and everything surrounding it, Cohn said. Steve Phillips, the Mets' general manager, really escalated things. He was very angry and very aggressive in his post-game comments. He shut down the weight room the next day when we went to Shea Stadium. Yankee players weren't allowed in the Mets' weight room the next day. He just kept it going. He said, 'Keep the players away from each other.' There was too much animosity. He escalated things. I thought that was a little out of line for a GM. That could have been handled by the players and managers. He unnecessarily escalated the situation, but he was upset." For the World Series, speculation was rampant about what would happen when Clemens and Piazza met again. Sports channels and news channels played endless loops of the July beaning. Would Clemens hit Piazza again? Would the Yankees pitch Clemens at Shea Stadium, where, under National League rules, he would take his turn at bat and be subject to getting hit himself as a retaliatory act by the Mets? We didn't need for that to happen, said Torrey, who slotted Clemens in Game 2 for the safety of pitching at Yankee Stadium. Roger told me, whatever you'd like me to do. I think Mel got to me and said that he'd rather not pitch at Shea, but he'd never admit that to me. Mel was remarkable. He'd get a sense for everything, or pitchers would talk to him before they'd talk to me, which is understandable. Mel Stottlemyre, Torrey's trusted pitching coach, was undergoing aggressive treatment for a bone marrow cancer known as multiple myeloma. At great risk of infections, he could not perform the duties of the pitching coach that year, but he continued to serve Torrey as an advisor. Steinbrenner invited him to Yankee Stadium for the first two games of the World Series. They would watch the games together from Torrey's office, the two of them eating cheeseburgers. The Yankees, as they always seemed to do in October, somehow won Game 1, even though they left 15 runners on base and were losing 3-2 with one out in the ninth inning with nobody on base against Mets closer Armando Benitez. The Mets' lead should have had a cushion to it, but the Yankees prospered from a base-running gaffe by Timo Perez in the sixth inning. With two outs, Perez might have scored from first base on a double off the wall by Todd Zeal, except for Perez falling into a jog when he assumed the ball was going to clear the wall for a home run. Derek Jeter, with yet another of his exquisitely timed comic book heroics, made Perez pay for the mistake with a perfect relay throw to the plate for the final out of the inning. Still, the Mets had the Yankees down to their final two outs with the bases clear when Benitez pitched to O'Neill. What happened next was the quintessential championship Yankees at-bat. A 10-pitch walk. It set the tone for the series, Torrey said. It was just a dare. You can't get me out. It was the loudest walk you've ever experienced. O'Neill fell behind Benitez, one ball and two strikes. 104 times during the regular season, Benitez had put hitters in a 1-2 snare, and only 19 times did they ever escape from that snare to reach base, leaving a lowly 18% chance of reaching base. O'Neill fought his way out of the predicament with the Yankees' trademark persistence, forged from that desperation to win from 1998. He fouled off two pitches, let two more go for balls, fouled off two more, and finally watched the 10th pitch sail out of the strike zone for ball 4. The rest of the rally carried the same familiar earmarks of Yankee ingenuity. Two opposite field singles, one by pinch hitter Luis Polonia and another by Luis Vizcaino, and a sacrifice fly by Chuck Knobloch, and the game was tied. Watching the Yankees rally like that over and over was like watching an old woman knit. Knit one, purl one, knit one, purl one. The repetition of executing simple tasks created something big. The Yankees would win in the 12th inning by stitching together a walk and three hits, the last of them an opposite field single by Vizcaino, off Wendell. Game 2 brought the main event, the WrestleMania matchup of Clemens versus Piazza. Torrey was sick of the hype, even angry about it. The feeling in Yankee Stadium that night was a rabid one. 3 months of hostility brought to a boil, fired by the incessant media fascination with the two stars. Torrey spoke briefly to his team before the game. "Let's not get caught up in the emotion of what they're trying to make this about," Torrey said. "We still have baseball to play, a team to beat." By then, Torrey had come to like and trust Clemens, who in his second year with the Yankees had become more a part of the team. There was less hiding around the back rooms of the basement of Yankee Stadium. "He was easy for me," Torrey said. "I have my rules about the national anthem and stretching. I'd get them sometimes, and sometimes I wouldn't notice. All of a sudden, Roger would come out to the field and say, 'Skip, I just put 300 on your desk.' Because I don't look for everybody when they come out for the national anthem. I don't think there was anything phony about Roger. He was who he was, and he was a good teammate." Clemens treated every one of his starts as if preparing for Armageddon, none with more emotion than Game 2 of the 2000 World Series. He had not pitched for 7 days since dominating the Mariners with that one hitter, the bulk of those days consumed by media reports of another showdown with Piazza. He also was worried about his mother, who would be sitting in the wheelchair section of Yankee Stadium with an oxygen tank to counter the effects of emphysema. She was there when Clemens pitched the 1999 World Series clincher, but had to leave after five innings because she grew so nervous and anxious that her breathing became more difficult. Clemens was also emotional about seeing the ill Stottlemyre in the clubhouse before the game. There was so much to think about even before throwing a pitch. Clemens lost himself in his usual pre-game preparation, which typically began with cranking the whirlpool to its hottest possible temperature. He'd come out looking like a lobster, trainer Steve Donahue said. Donahue then would rub hot liniment all over Clemens' body, from his ankles to his wrists, Donahue said. Then Donahue would rub the hottest possible liniment on his testicles. He'd start snorting like a bull, the trainer said. That's when he was ready to pitch, said Donahue. Roger was a warrior and a fighter. His intensity was not the same as David Cone's. You didn't even talk to Coney when the game started. Roger could talk about fishing, hunting, umpires. Between innings, almost every inning, was like a prize fight with Roger. It was like he was coming back to his corner in between rounds. He'd come in and you'd have to have your surgical gloves on, ready to go. He might say, "Give me the red hot on the back," or, "Give me some grease on my elbow." You really had to pay attention when he had two outs because the first thing that would come off were the shirts. He had all dry shirts lined up. Then we'd have two or three grades of hot stuff lined up. He'd get the medium on the back and the next to hottest on the elbow, and he'd get all greased up, and then he'd have to put talcum on him so he could put his shirt on over the grease, and then he'd go back out there for the fight. Clemens went out for his usual bullpen warm-up. Mike Borzello would catch him at the start. McNamee would observe, always checking some cranky body part, back, hamstring, groin, that needed extra observation. Posada would arrive in time to catch the last 20 pitches, with McNamee assuming stances as a left-handed and right-handed batter. "Phew! How many times did he almost smoke my ass?" McNamee said. Clemens would finish by working through pitch sequences on two virtual batters. Then he would wipe the sweat from his brow, rub it on the Babe Ruth Monument in Monument Park for good luck, and get down to the business of intimidating grown men with the flight path and velocity of a thrown baseball. It was 8:05 p.m. when Clemens threw his first pitch. He would say later that night, "I don't remember ever being more ready for a start, but I also knew I had to control it somehow." He was positively ferocious from the start, blowing pitches past the Mets with the heat and force of an acetylene torch. Timo Perez, the first batter, struck out on a 97-mile-per-hour fastball. Edgardo Alfonso whiffed on a ridiculously fast 94-mile-per-hour splitter. Piazza was next. The crowd was nearly barbaric in its frenzy. Clemens clearly was more amped than his usual warrior-like self. "I was anxious all day," he said after the game, at 2 a.m. in the Yankees parking lot, still edgy. "I really had a hard time with it. I felt like I couldn't go up and in, which I normally would do on him, because what if I did? What if one got away? With all the talk, it really wore me down. I kept telling myself, 'You've got to get a hold of your emotions.' Everything was building up to it. It was so hard to get a hold of my emotions." The first two pitches were 97-mile-per-hour missiles that Piazza took each time for strikes. "You couldn't even see the plate with all the flash bulbs," McNamee said. "I was in the bullpen and you couldn't even see the batter after all the lights." Clemens tried a splitter next, but missed, running the count to 1-2. The next pitch was an inside fastball, full of anger and machismo, a buzzsaw of a pitch that bore through the handle of Piazza's bat as he tried to hit it. Objects flew every which way in the manner of an explosion. One piece of the bat flew toward the left side of the infield. The handle stayed in Piazza's hands. The ball flew into foul territory off first base. The biggest remaining part of the bat, the barrel, sheared off with a shard at one end, bounced toward Clemens. There was so much going on, so much in his head, so much emotion coursing through his body that Clemens could not process the inventory of what was happening at that moment quickly enough. He picked up the barrel as if fielding a grounder. In fact, he would say that his first thought was that he was fielding the baseball. And when he realized it was a useless piece of wood in his hands, he threw it. Through it, he said, toward what he thought was a safe area out of play, simply to get this damn piece of wood, by extension, this piece of piazza, off the field. Piazza, however, happened to be right near the flight path of the barrel. Piazza was confused himself. He had no idea where the ball was, so he began jogging toward first base just in case it might be in play somewhere. The bat careened and cartwheeled not too far in front of him. Piazza was stunned. "What is your problem?" he yelled at Clemens. "What is your problem?" Clemens did not respond. He spoke to home plate umpire Charlie Relaford about how he thought it was the ball. That was just Roger's pent-up frustration, McNamee said of the bat-throwing incident, because that was the first time he saw him since July. He was hyped. That was just emotion. It was nothing. He didn't throw the bat at Piazza. And Roger reads every fucking one of the stories. His sisters read everything and talk to him. He finds out about it. He's got people all over the internet. That cockamamie story about the ball, that's bullshit. I think he was just so hyped up and focused. Said Tori. Roger was on another planet, obviously. He gets the bat and he throws it away, just throws it off the field. Piazza, not knowing where the ball was, he started running. Clemens knew it was a foul ball, and he just threw the bat toward the dugout. Turns out Piazza ran into it almost. Relaford moved between Clemens and Piazza. Both dugouts emptied. The situation was quelled quickly. On the next pitch, Clemens retired Piazza on a ground ball to second base. Clemens, still highly emotional and amped, ran off the field and kept going, past Torrey, up the runway and into the clubhouse. This time it had nothing to do with changing his shirt. Stottlemyre jumped up from eating his cheeseburger with Steinbrenner in Torrey's office and made his way toward Clemens.
"I didn't mean to do that,"
Clemens said. When Stottlemyre reached Clemens, he found a most surprising sight. Clemens, the intimidating warrior who put hot liniment on his balls, who snorted like a bull, who threw 97 miles an hour with more than a hint of danger affixed to his pitches, sat there crying uncontrollably. While Clemens, with Stottlemyre's help, pulled himself together, his teammates scored 2 runs for him. By the 8th inning, the Yankees led 6-0, and Clemens was nearly unhittable. He faced 28 batters. 2 managed hits, none walked, 9 struck out, and only 5 managed to get the ball out of the infield, safely or not. The Mets put up 5 runs in the 9th off Jeff Nelson and Mariano Rivera. Piazza hit a home run off Nelson. But the night belonged to Clemens and the Yankees, 6-5. Competition, Mets catcher Todd Pratt said that night, brings out the best and worst in people. The next day, a workout day before Game 3, Cone asked Torrey if he could speak to him for a minute. Torrey had not yet announced his starting pitcher for Game 4. He had Orlando Hernandez lined up for Game 3, a game the Yankees would lose 4-2, when El Duque was touched for 2 runs in the 8th, but had yet to decide between Nagel and Cone for Game 4. Joe didn't have a lot of faith in Nagel, Cone said. Nagel rubbed him the wrong way for some reason. He thought he was a little flighty. There was something about him he didn't like. Cone, though, was far from a sure thing. He had pitched only 1 inning in the ALCS against Seattle, a mop-up inning at that, in a 6-2 game. The body of the inspirational leader of the championship Yankees teams was breaking down. Cone suffered through a dreadful season, going 4-14 with a 6.91 ERA. I got to a point in my career where I learned how to manage the pain, Cone said. I learned how many Advil I had to take, or when I really got in trouble I could take something heavier, Indocin, or other anti-inflammatories. I had been through it enough that I knew how to manage the pain. What I didn't know was how short my stuff was getting. I almost got too good at managing the pain because I didn't recognize my stuff got short. Lots of hanging sliders that year. My slider just stopped breaking. Toward the end of the season, Cone dislocated his left shoulder diving for a ball. I shouldn't have been on the playoff roster, he said. I was throwing with one arm. You really need that drive from the front side. For the rest of the year, I had nothing. Cohn threw no harder than 85 miles an hour in that one inning against Seattle. He knew Torrey was considering a start for him, which is why he asked to speak with the manager on that workout day. "Hey, look, Joe," Cohn told him, "I'm pretty comfortable I can give you a couple of innings of relief, but I'm not sure what I can give you as a starter." Said Cohn, "That was the first time I ever admitted that. To anybody. To admit that I can't do it." Torrey thanked him for his honesty and announced Nagel as the Yankees' Game 4 pitcher. Jeter hit that important first pitch home run off Bobby Jones to begin Game 4. The Yankees pushed the lead to 3-0 by the third inning, but Nagel gave back two of the runs by serving up a home run to Piazza in the bottom of the third. It was still 3-2 in the fifth when Piazza came up with two outs and nobody on base. Torrey walked out to the mound. Nagel was one out away from qualifying for a World Series win. But Torrey wanted no part of watching Nagel pitch to Piazza a second time. He signaled to the bullpen. Torrey managed postseason games with cutthroat urgency, a policy that began in his first postseason series as Yankees manager with advice from Zimmer. Torrey's starter Kenny Rogers was getting hit hard by the Rangers in the second inning of Game 4 when Zimmer turned to Torrey and said, "You might want to get someone up in the bullpen." "What?" Torrey said. "It's only the second inning." "You can never let these games get away from you," Zimmer said. Torrey pulled Rogers after only two innings, down 2-0. The Yankees won the game 6-4. He never forgot Zimmer's lesson. In Game 4 of the 2000 World Series, Nagel was the latest version of Rogers. He handed Torrey the ball and walked off dejectedly. Nagel would later explain, "I'm a victim of not having done it long enough for Joe." The bullpen door swung open and out jogged the clubhouse rascal whom O'Neill wanted to maul before the game, the same guy with the 4-14 record, the 85-mile-per-hour fastball, the dislocated shoulder, and the heart of a lion. It was time for one last Yankee moment for David Cohn. "He couldn't get me or you out," Torrey said. "But I knew you plant some thoughts in Mike Piazza's head." "Oh, shit. Now I've got to look for more than one pitch." "When a certain hitter like Piazza knows he's going to get that one pitch eventually, he'll kill you. But with Coney, he goes out there and throws buckshot at you. He's all over the joint." Cohn figured at some point in the game he might be called on to face Piazza. He just didn't figure that point would come with Nagel one out away from qualifying for a World Series victory. "It just goes to show you, Joe didn't care," Cohn said. "One thing Joe set the tone on early was that he was not going to play favorites. Yeah, he was a little bit of a riverboat gambler in terms of strategy, but he was going to put the team on the field that gave him the best chance to win at that point. If that meant sitting Tino in the postseason, sitting Boggs, taking Nagel out with two outs in the fifth and not letting him face Piazza one more time, he was going to do it. He didn't care who you were or what was going on. He was going to do whatever he was going to do to help the team win. Guys didn't like it, but too bad. Tino didn't like it, but he accepted it. He dealt with it." Cohn's savvy served him well. He knew, for instance, that Piazza was the type of hitter who liked to take a strike. "To me, that's half the battle," Cohn said, "knowing which guys will spot you a strike or not." So, even after Cohn missed with his first pitch, he came back with a fastball that caught a lot of the plate. Piazza took it for strike one. "That," Cohn said, "was a pitch he could have mashed. But I was really confident he wasn't going to swing at the 1-0 fastball. And once I got the strike, I threw him two sliders, one he swung at and missed, and one he barely fouled off. Decent sliders, kind of sweeping frisbee sliders. Then Posada called a fastball in, so I thought maybe I'll miss in with it. It got a little more of the plate than I wanted. It was up just enough. The last thing he was looking for was a fastball anywhere in there. It was just the luck of the draw. He reacted late and just missed it, popped it up." Said Torrey, "He was looking off speed and he threw him an 85-mile-an-hour fastball down the middle and he hit a pop-up." It was a triumph of trust. Torrey wanted Cohn on Piazza, even with an 85-mile-per-hour fastball, and Cohn came through for him. It was the last pitch Cohn would throw in his great career with the Yankees. Cohn was going to pitch another inning, but Torrey used Jose Canseco to pinch hit for him with two outs and two on. Canseco whiffed. Nelson, Stanton, and Rivera took care of the final 12 outs to keep the score at 3-2. The Yankees the next night won the World Series for the last time under Torrey. It was the perfect coda, straight out of the 1996 through 2000 Greatest Hits songbook. There was, of course, a comeback. They trailed 2-1 in the sixth inning. There was Jeter playing the superhero again. He tied the game with a home run. There was terrific starting pitching. Andy Pettit allowed two unearned runs in seven innings. There was the prototypical game-winning rally of Yankee ingenuity. The Yankees had two outs and nobody on base in the ninth when Posada drew a nine-pitch walk from Al Leiter. Brocious added an infield single, and Luis Soho added a ground ball single that, coupled with an error, sent two runs home for a 4-2 lead. And, of course, at the end, there was Rivera, getting the final out on a fly ball by Piazza, the potential tying run. After Soho's game-breaking hit, technicians and carpenters from Fox hustled to the Yankees' clubhouse to begin erecting the platform for the presentation of the commissioner's trophy. But there was a problem. The door was locked. They knocked on it, announcing themselves. Steinbrenner shouted, "Don't let those bastards in!" He was superstitious about having anyone assuming the Yankees had the world championship in hand. No one, he decided, was coming into his clubhouse until after the last out. Commissioner Bud Selig, with word reaching him in the stands, was apoplectic. His television partners needed to get in. Kevin Hallinan, Major League Baseball's director of security, called a Yankees official in the clubhouse and told him that the Yankees were risking an enormous fine from Selig if Steinbrenner didn't open the door immediately. Steinbrenner sent word that the only person he would talk to was Paul Beeston, one of Selig's assistants and a friend of Steinbrenner's from Beeston's years running the Toronto Blue Jays. Beeston, in fact, was friendly enough with Steinbrenner to have pulled a prank on him a few years earlier, when he helped arrange an owners' meeting in which all of the owners came dressed as Steinbrenner. Gray slacks, navy blue blazer, white turtleneck. Beeston banged on the door. "George, it's Beeston. Open the door," he called out. Steinbrenner opened the door a bit, just wide enough for Beeston and no one else to slip through before he slammed it shut. Beeston calmly negotiated with Steinbrenner to open the door and let the TV people do their job. Steinbrenner eventually relented, but not without warning Beeston, "But if anything goes wrong, this is on you." Only a few minutes later, Rivera leapt in the air after getting Piazza to fly out to Bernie Williams. Steinbrenner was crying on the shoulder of a very relieved Beeston. Soon the champagne was flying yet again. It never grew old. Every champagne celebration was full of exuberance and joy, though with each year more and more relief crept in there as well. "We had a blast afterward," McNamee said. "I was sitting on top of the refrigerator in that little room, and George came up to me and shook my hand, said, 'Congratulations!' I don't think he knew who I was. I just know for like a good 30 minutes after the champagne was gone, almost everybody on the team was in that room. Guys were laughing, and every 5 minutes somebody would say, 'And this is for Turk Wendell.' So we toasted him like 10 times. Like we'd be talking, 'Hey, isn't this great?' And then some guy would raise his hand and go, 'To Turk Wendell!' And everybody would be cheering. It was pretty funny. They might have had a chance if he didn't open his mouth. Oh, he pissed everybody off. That Yankees team was not that good." Didn't all the October nights in those years seem to end the same way? Watching the Yankees in the postseason those years was like watching a Gilligan's Island episode. No matter what outrageous plot twists and red herrings were thrown into the opening minutes of the show, you knew how it was going to end. Gilligan was still going to be on the island when they ran the credits. Likewise, no matter if the Yankees fell behind or were tied or were confronted with a rally, you knew they were going to come out ahead. From 1998 through 2000, the Yankees won 3 consecutive world championships by playing .805 baseball in the postseason, going 33-8. Even as their talent waned, they seemed to know their way around the postseason better than anyone else, as if they had the only map to the buried treasure. Pitching, of course, was their compass. They allowed 0, 1, or 2 runs in 23 of those 41 games. But there was something else that existed inside and between these players. It was something so strong that they took all the common logic of small sample sizes, the randomness of when two good teams meet in the playoffs, and the difficulty of having to get through 3 rounds of playoffs, and they blew up all of what is now that conventional wisdom. Those 3 Yankee teams, for instance, were 15-3 in playoff games decided by 1 or 2 runs. Were they that lucky? Or were they that good? The randomness existed then, said Bean, the father of the modern philosophy that the playoffs are a crapshoot. But at some point, you are like UCLA basketball under John Wooden. They won what, 12 titles in a postseason where you can get knocked out in 1 game? At some point, a team becomes so good that they overcome the randomness. The 98 Yankees were one of the greatest teams I ever saw. That team was almost as good in 99 and 2000. They were without a doubt the UCLA of baseball in that time. They had everything you'd want a baseball team to have. And they were young. And let's face it, when you're that good, it's a pretty overwhelming environment for another team to go in and try to beat them. They were that much better than anybody else. 4 times in all, Torrey's Yankees rode down the Canyon of Heroes in Lower Manhattan while honored with a parade. 4 times they added to the Yankees' legacy as the most prestigious franchise in sports, with 26 world championships in all. Yet there was a downside to the glory. Steinbrenner, who was desperate for a winner when Torrey arrived, having endured 17 years without a title, now had come to expect these championships. Each title brought him a little less joy. The Yankees could do no better than to fulfill an obligation. A short time after the 2000 World Series, with the Yankees having dispatched their crosstown rivals in a bitterly fought series, and the YES Network cleared for launch with what remained the preeminent team in sports, Torrey and his wife were getting ready to board a plane for Europe when his phone rang. It was Steinbrenner. "I'm not giving the coaches a bonus this year," the boss said. Steinbrenner had handed out $25,000 bonuses to Torrey's coaches when the Yankees won in 1996, 1998, and 1999. "George," Torrey said, "how can you give the coaches a bonus when we beat San Diego, and then when we beat the Mets you can't give them a bonus? That's crazy." "Well," Steinbrenner said, "they're expected to win." A few weeks later, Steinbrenner called Torrey again. It was New Year's Eve. "I'm going to give the coaches a bonus," Steinbrenner said. Who knew what changed his mind? All Torrey knew was that he was happy for his coaches, but still angry that Steinbrenner didn't believe they deserved a bonus in the first place. "Still, you go through the same act with George," Torrey said. "You thank him, you tell him what a great owner he is, and how much you appreciate it. You mean it, but you're also thinking, why is this necessary? But see, that's the only control he had. That's what he used to get my attention, because he wanted to see me squirm. So it was basically a game. At least you had access to him. I worked for Ted Turner and I worked for August Bush, and it was easier to work for George because you had access to him. You could talk to him. You could get to him. You could get your point across. You could never get to those guys to talk to them." Steinbrenner's declining appreciation for what his team accomplished, however, was taking a toll on the morale of the organization. His scouts and player development people, for instance, did not receive their 1999 World Series rings until more than a year later, until after the 2000 World Series, and when they did receive them, they turned out to be fake ones. The ring company eventually sent them word to return the rings so they could correct the mistake. Still, no 2000 World Series rings were forthcoming for the scouts, numbering about 24. Morale worsened when they were instructed not to bring up the subject of World Series rings at organizational meetings. It worsened still when they heard or saw Steinbrenner cronies, such as actor Billy Crystal and singer Ronan Tynan, wearing World Series rings. The daughter of one scout wrote a scathing letter to Steinbrenner about the withholding of rings from the people who worked so hard behind the scenes to help build the championship team. Steinbrenner relented, and eventually ordered a ring for that one scout. Another player development official put his request in writing. He insisted that he would not sign his next contract until it included the promise of a 2000 World Series ring. Nearly all of the scouts, however, never did receive a 2000 World Series ring. The bit of black humor among them, considering how long it took them to receive the 1999 World Series rings, was that the Yankees would have to win another World Series for them to receive the 2000 World Series rings. But no rings were ever forthcoming for the scouts, and in fact Cashman told Newsday in 2006, after he assumed full authority in baseball operations, that those people would not be receiving them. As the years went by, the jilted scouts began to refer to each lost Yankees season after 2000 as the result of what they called the curse of the rings. The Yankees have not won a World Series since. 5. Mystique and Aura. In the middle of the sixth inning of the seventh game of the 2001 World Series, Joe Torre retreated to the clubhouse to use the bathroom. George Steinbrenner was waiting for him as Torre walked up a short flight of stairs. The Yankees owner had taken his customary position in the clubhouse to watch his team play in the postseason. "What do you think?" Steinbrenner asked him. Torre knew exactly what Steinbrenner wanted, another shot of reassurance. "He was a wreck," Torre said. Many times over the years, Torre had calmed Steinbrenner's jangled nerves and fears. It was Torre's nature to be reassuring, even going back to 1962, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when he was in the Air National Guard and was in charge of 50 troops at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas. One night, while on a march, the troops were moaning about the possibility of being sent off to a war. "Don't worry," Torre told them. "We're not going off to war." The troops believed him and immediately felt better. Torre had no inside information himself. He simply figured if they did not go to war, he would look smart, and if they did go to war, well, they would have bigger things to worry about than what their dorm chief had told them. It was the same way with Steinbrenner. Torre told the boss the Yankees would win with rookie pitchers in a doubleheader against the mighty Indians in 1996, and they did. He told Steinbrenner the Yankees would win 4 games in a row against the powerful Braves in the 1996 World Series, and they did. He told him Orlando Hernandez was ready to pitch the pivotal Game 4 of the 1998 ALCS, and Hernandez threw a gem. He told him Andy Pettitte was too good to trade, and Pettitte went 75-35 for Steinbrenner. This time, however, was different. As Torre stood there in the visiting clubhouse of Bank One Ballpark, he looked Steinbrenner in the eye and realized he could not tell Steinbrenner what he wanted to hear. Torre had no words of reassurance this time. Fact was, with Arizona Diamondbacks pitcher Curt Schilling on top of his game and the Yankees' offense looking mostly anemic throughout the series, not even Torre could muster an optimistic picture to give Steinbrenner. The reassurance well was dry. "Boss," Torre said, "I wish I could give you something positive, but I don't know if we're ever going to score a run here. I wish the hell I knew, George." That the Yankees were still playing at all, down 1-0 to Schilling and the Diamondbacks in Game 7, was in itself a colossal achievement. The dynasty was running low on fuel. Age continued to bring the Yankees down another notch from their 1998 pinnacle. For the third straight season since that 1998 juggernaut, the Yankees' run production diminished. They scored more than a full run a game less than they did in 1998, and dipped below an average of 5 runs per game for the first time since a dismal 1992 outfit that lost 86 games. The 2001 Yankees' on-base percentage, once the prideful signature of a team that grinded out every at-bat, sunk to .334, which would be the worst in Torre's 12 years with the Yankees, and the franchise's worst since that 1992 team. The Yankees resorted to stealing bases. They stole 161 bases, the franchise's second most since 1916, and trusting that their pitching would carry them through close games. Clemens won the Cy Young Award with a 20-3 record, while Mike Messina, the free agent prize signed to replace Cohn, led the staff in innings, ERA, and strikeouts. Mariano Rivera saved 50 games, while the Yankees went 30-18 in one-run games, the first time the Yankees won so many games by the slimmest possible margin since 1980. The youthful Athletics, with 102 victories and a dynamite rotation that recalled the 1995 Braves, and the deep, resourceful Mariners, with a league-record 116 victories, were the ascendant teams, the Yankees' likely successors. The Yankees, on their way to 95 wins, went largely unchallenged in the second half in the American League East, thanks to a long fade by the Red Sox. On the morning of September 11th, Torrey woke up to a comfortable 13-game lead over Boston. He was getting out of bed when his phone rang. It was his car service calling about a scheduled appointment to take Torrey to an appearance in Manhattan later that morning. "I guess it's canceled," the man from the car service said. "What's canceled?" Torrey said. "You haven't heard?" The man told him about the plane that had crashed into one of the twin towers of the World Trade Center. Torrey turned on the television, only to see a second plane strike the other tower. "My first thought was my daughter," Torrey said. "She was not quite six yet. I was trying to flip the TV stations around to make sure she had some cartoons or something. My wife was working out, and she came up and I told her. She had the TV on in the kitchen, and me and my daughter were in the living room. It was absolutely frightening. I thought about my son. He used to be at the World Trade Center. I tried to get a hold of him on the phone. My sister-in-law Katie, one of Allie's sisters, was a flight attendant with American Airlines. She was in another country. That was our priority at that point, to find out where everybody we knew was. My son was living in New Jersey at the time. He was just on the other side of the Holland Tunnel, the Jersey side. Life in America was put on anxious hold. Many of the mundane pursuits of everyday living, such as air travel and Major League Baseball, were meaningless in the great vortex of grief and anxiety that consumed the country. Some of the players fled to their families. Roger Clemens, for instance, drove from New York to Texas. On September 15th, the Yankees, who were still in town, gathered after a workout to visit the Jacob Javits Center, which had been transformed into an emergency staging area, St. Vincent's Hospital, where survivors were expected to be treated, and the New York Armory, another staging area that had become a gathering place for families looking for lost loved ones. Derek Jeter, Bernie Williams, Chuck Knobloch, and several of the coaches joined Torrey on the Goodwill mission. "It was obviously emotional," Torrey said. "You go to St. Vincent's Hospital and there was nobody there. I think we went up and saw a firefighter who had smoke inhalation, but no people from the building that were in it when the plane hit." The most emotional part was the armory. You go to the staging area and you see the workers and you shake their hands. And there were people waiting on results, DNA results, to see where their loved ones were. That was the toughest one, because we walked in. I didn't even want to go in. But then I remember that Randy Levine sent somebody in, or he might have gone in, just to see what the mood was. And the people who were in there wanted us to go in there. I think I realized at that point in time there was a purpose for us being there. We didn't know all these people, who were certainly devastated and huddled around in different groups. You'd look around and see that they had counselors or priests or rabbis in different family settings. We sort of just walked in there and looked around. And then somebody looked up and sort of waved us in, a family member. They brought out pictures of the family members they were waiting on. Pictures of them wearing Yankee hats. Big Yankees fans. Which was pretty moving. The Yankees were part of their community at a time of great need. Williams, for instance, walked up to one grieving woman. "I don't know what to say," Williams said, "but you look like you need a hug." And the center fielder of the Yankees reached out and embraced her. "I realized at that point," Torrey said, "we had to take a certain perspective for the rest of the season." Word reached Torrey that the Yankees would fly to Tampa the next day, a Sunday, to play the Devil Rays for one game only on Monday, and then fly to Chicago after the game for a series against the White Sox. I thought, that doesn't make sense. I don't have players here, Torrey said. I argued with George and he relented. The plan changed. The Yankees would not fly to Tampa. They would fly to Chicago to work out Monday and resume the season Tuesday. Torrey held a brief meeting with his team before the game. "The NY on our caps," he told them, "is all about New York and not about the Yankees." Orlando Hernandez, the Cuban refugee who had come to America for its freedoms, stymied the White Sox that night with 7 shutout innings as the Yankees won 11-3. The Yankees had become not just New York's team, but also America's hometown team. "There were lots of big banners in Chicago supporting New York," Torrey said. "It was like an out-of-body experience watching all that stuff. You didn't know how important it was, what we were doing. It was just sort of feeling your way through it." Clemens was the Yankees' starting pitcher the next night. "I remember him getting focused," McNamee said. "When it's a big game, we can have a 20-minute conversation, and he won't remember it. He knew what it represented. I said, 'Listen, man, you understand the importance of this game.' We always talked like this. Sometimes it would get in, sometimes it wouldn't. That's how I worked. That's how I would treat a guy in preparation. We talked, and it was huge. I just tried to make sure that he didn't try to do too much, which he's capable of trying to do. That's how the conversation went, but he had that look on his face, just a glare. The next day we'd talk about it, and he wouldn't even know what the fuck I said." Clemens, following the lead of Hernandez,